Hello, everyone, and welcome to our panel on character and religious leadership. My name is Michael Lamb, and I direct the program for leadership and character here at Wake Forest. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce the moderator for today's panel, Dr. Jill Crenshaw. Dr. Crenshaw is Vice Dean for Faculty Development and Academic Initiatives and Blackburn Professor of Worship and Liturgical Theology at Wake Forest School of Divinity. She's also our university ombud, an award-winning teacher and renowned scholar of wisdom and liturgy. She's the author of 5 books, including most recently, a book of poetry called Cedars in Snowy Places. Welcome, Dr. Crenshaw.
Good morning. Welcome to everyone to this discussion of character and religious leadership. I am excited to be here to gain from the wisdom of our conversation partners. First, though, I want to thank Michael Lamb, Kenneth Townsend, and the whole character and the professions planning team for coordinating this important conference. I'm honored to stand on sacred ground today with amazing conversation partners to talk about matters vital to our communal and global well-being. So let me introduce these conversation partners for our time together with this panel discussion. First, Walter Earl Fluker is the Dean's Professor for Spirituality, Ethics, and Leadership at the Candler School of Theology at Emory University and Professor Emeritus of Ethical Leadership. Deb Richardson Moore is an award-winning reporter and an alumna of Wake Forest University. She is the author of 4 fiction books and her memoir called The Weight of Mercy. Najiba Saeed is Associate Professor of Muslim and Interreligious Studies at Chicago Theological Seminary. She is currently Chief of Staff to Los Angeles City Council member Nithya Raman. Shmuley Yankowitz is a rabbi, author, and activist. He is the founder of multiple nonprofit activist organizations and has authored over 18 books, including most recently, The Book of Jonah, a social justice commentary, and The Soul of Activism, a spirituality for social change. I know you share my eagerness to hear our panelists' wisdom on the topic of character and religious leadership. Again, I am honored to be able to be here with each of you and all of you together. And I'd like to begin with a kind of general question that each of you can answer in your own way that will get us started. So again, welcome to our panelists. Welcome to those who are here for this discussion. And here is that first question. What does character mean to you, and why do you think character is important for religious leaders? So I'll just let you all jump in as you feel led, and hope each of you will make an effort to share your wisdom on this particular question.
Okay, well, I guess I'll start then, since you introduced me first. Hi, so nice to be here, and Jill, thanks for heading this up for us. I guess to me, character is the very foundation of who we are in religious leadership. And I feel like so often a minister's role is so all-encompassing. It's almost impossible to be good at everything. To be a really dynamic preacher, an engaging teacher, a good administrator, a good pastoral caregiver. And yet, I think if we do not have that foundation of a deep integrity, there is going to be rot from within. And so any of those skills that we may have or not have are eventually going to founder and fall if there is not that absolute commitment to integrity and living out our faith. And so to me, it's just foundational.
Thank you, Deb.
If I might speak to character, I'm still resonating with Professor Walton's powerful, powerful presentation. I like to think of character as a narrative quest for the unity of consciousness. It is foundational. I agree with Deborah. It is also a quest. It is a dynamic, ongoing process where I think particularly leaders and religious leaders especially are always in the process of remembering, retelling, and reliving their own stories within the context of larger social historical narratives. So character for me is not simply something that I have or some mechanical part or dimension of myself that I can fix. I'm always in the process of becoming, practicing over and over again, the narrative of which I'm a part. And so in that respect, leaders, religious leaders, are always inquiring about ways in which they've been formed by certain traditions, often more than one, but also ways in which they are reframing those traditions or retelling those traditions in order to relive those traditions in public space.
Thank you for that wonderful insight. I can't help but harken back to the conversation or the question that was asked about ritual formation, because I hear in what you're saying that it's a constant repeating and a rhythm of becoming. And so we form people through our actions and through this becoming into the narratives that we are and that we aspire to be. I really appreciate that wisdom. Shmuley, do you have something to add to this definition and conversation?
This has been very rich already, and I'm grateful to be a part of this very wonderful, important conversation. And I think the demands of faith relevancy today place new demands on clergy, which can challenge the very character we're seeking to pursue and cultivate. And as has been shared, I do believe that striving to be godly is the most important part of the profession. And I almost push back on calling it a profession, because I from personal experience and with my colleagues, believe that because we're talking about character, this is about a lifestyle. It's not about a profession. It really transcends being a profession, how one represents this role. And yet, it's very complex. The character is very complex because we're dealing with dozens of different traits, and those different character traits oftentimes conflict with one another in terms of, so the question is not just how do we be good, it's which kind of good do we want to be? And prior to the Enlightenment, our classical texts of various traditions emphasized choose the good, not the evil, be good, not bad. And it was pretty clear in a fundamentalist orientation, you just have to do the good. Everybody knows what the good is. And then in Enlightenment and modernity, the question becomes, well, what is the good? So what is the character we're trying to pursue? And so what is good character to one might be bad character to another. And so it's actually quite complex to determine not only how important character is, but which character we wish to pursue. The last thing I'll say at the moment is that this challenge that we see here is about shifting from the consciousness of speech and action towards the realm of being. And we often judge people by what they say and what they do, and that makes sense. And yet we're moving from a to-do list to a to-be list, right? And that's a pretty radical shift in spiritual consciousness of what do we wish to emanate in the world in addition to our actions and speech.
Thank you so much, Shmuley. Najiba, do you want to add here?
I think we can really draw on the work of Robert Bella, a sociologist of religion, who talks about the importance of a collective in the spiritual formation, whether in the public square or the private square, and warned us about a time when, I think as we heard in the keynote this morning, warned us of a time when we might have such a level of sort of individuated or self-appropriated form of religion that it becomes, as he called it, a Sheilaism, down to one person named Sheila as an example. And so I would add that, particularly considering what's happened in the last week, the role of women in the collective of a family coming, I'm an immigrant myself, coming from an Asian American family, that very often Asaba Mahmoud in her research on women's educational spaces in Egypt said that very often ethicists do not recognize spaces, as she calls them, of ethical cultivation, because these were spaces where women were teaching other women, and the spiritual formation for a collective is not often, if we use the word clergy or vocation or profession, we leave out many who are responsible for the deep formation and the ethical cultivation. So Saba's work helps us, she's passed away, Saba Mahmoud's work helps us think about where are the spaces in communities where collectives are established and there's a socialization process. I'll just give you an example of my own mother. Every night before we would go to bed, she would say, "What have your hands done to serve someone else? What have your feet done? What has your heart done?" So we would literally go through our body parts and talk about what we had done for others. And it seems like a simple, prosaic kind of conversation, but in what she was doing was socializing us and forming us. And I'll end that. I think there's often right now a language, sort of a language, of a morbid language around the death of spaces of cultivation. And I think one of my papers for my for a book edited by one of my mentors, Glenn Stassen, looked at how Muslim women are using, at that time, 10 years ago, Facebook for spiritual formation. And again, women creating social capital and religious capital through social media, and how women's movements across and liberation movements and revolutions across the Middle East, women were supporting one another through social media. So there are even collectives. I think very often when religious scholars, when we look at collectives, to understand that in social media, collectives are being formed. And because of COVID, many of our religious institutions are now online. And that is seen as the death, but I would say it's also the rebirth and the reformation and the collapsing of certain systems that may not have given voice to others that were marginalized.
Thank you for that. That's a wonderful word. As I think, as I hear each of you talk about your perspectives on character and religious leadership, I think about how we, in our, well, I'm in a theological school at the Divinity School, and many of us either are connected to or teach persons who are aspiring to be religious leaders in their communities. So how do we educate people in this world of character and religious leadership? What do we need to do to improve the way we do education for character? I know that I'm a Presbyterian clergy person, and I'm the person who teaches what we call our healthy boundaries required trainings to clergy. And I think that's one, only one very thin dimension of what ministerial ethics is all about. It really focuses primarily on sexual misconduct. So what do we do to broaden that and to tap into some of these wonderful definitions of character that you've shared here? How do we educate this in our seminary students?
I don't want to keep jumping in first. Does someone else want to go?
You should go first.
Okay. All right. I so clearly remember my seminary days because they came very late in life. I was 46, I think, when I entered seminary. And so it was a different perspective than had I been 22, obviously. And I just remember the idea of arrogance and humility. Just resounding so powerfully. And I think arrogance has no place in seminary education in divinity school. And last night, the panel had a governor, and he was talking about he would never hire a narcissist again. And the moderator said, "If you've got a screening for that, let us know." But I think that arrogance and that narcissism all comes together. And that is something that we want to guard against in our mentorship of these divinity students. Mm-hmm. And to put, place a positive spin on it, I think what we have to do is cultivate humility. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, there are lots of places in scripture that I don't know what the heck they're talking about. And I think we need to admit that and not to try to come across as be all, know all, and just admit there are very, there are plenty of places where there is absolute clarity, and that's fine. But when there is not, that we don't need to force a positiveness and a know-it-all-ness when it's not there. Just one quick story. When Jonathan Walton was at Harvard, he had me come speak. And that was just so stunning that the Greenville News did a story on it, kind of like, why is she going to Harvard? And to speak at his church. Well, as soon as we got home, my husband said, well, you need to invite Jonathan to come to Triune. And the church where I pastored had a large homeless element to our congregation. And you know, we were in the deep South, and I said, oh my gosh, I can't invite him here. What, you know, what in the world? He would think I was crazy. And my husband just kept on, and he kept saying, I think Jonathan would enjoy that. And I said, there's nothing that he could gain from it. Well, finally, about 4 years later, I finally worked up my nerve and invited Jonathan. And of course, he said, yes, I will be glad to come. And he came and he spent the weekend with us. And he, as you know, he was just so just extraordinarily kind, spoke to Furman professors as it, just like he spoke to our homeless men. And what he said to me when we had dinner was, what took you so long? Why did you wait so long to invite me? And to me, that is humility, for someone to come and to behave like that with nothing to gain. And that's what I think we need to aim for.
Deborah, you remind me of a statement by Howard Thurman. He says, humility cannot be humiliated. And it's no small wonder that pride is a cardinal sin in Christian traditions. And it's something that religious leaders in particular ought to be aware. I wanted to return to, and in response to the question, I wanted to return to Jonathan Walton's statement to, but the question by the young man at Morehouse, how can I expand my brand? And I can understand why you would leave that open, but maybe a Socratic method that would return to the young man and ask him this question, not what is your brand, but what is your name? What is your name? And what does that name mean? For me, in classes that I teach on ethical leadership, the first step in character is the question of identity. And this is important because we have very diverse traditions that show up in our classrooms. For instance, I taught at Boston University for many years. And in one class, I could have Christians, I could have Muslims, I could have Buddhists, I could have atheists, I have often had nuns, so to speak, as they were defined. And so the question becomes, what is your name, as a question of identity? And it wars against what Peter Bloom calls the ethical capitalist subject. That is how neoliberalism that Jonathan points to both forms a certain kind of character, and also that character becomes accountable or responsible for perpetuating a system that alienates the person from himself or herself. So this work around identity, finding one's name in the midst of all of the flux and quote unquote postmodernist quagmires that we find ourselves in becomes vitally important. My last point is that with character, I also wed character to public space and to the larger ideal of community. Public space is where we practice civility, certain kinds of civility, not simply good etiquette, but in our case, for instance, what would be etiquette of state? What is at stake in order to share a common good, a common goal? So that kind of civility becomes transformative civility, not dysfunctional civility, but a transformative civility that is wedded to character with a larger goal and emphasis on community, how we belong together, how do we live together, with all of our differences, but also with perhaps some common goods.
Great, I would be happy to go next. So I also wanted to have us think about when religion codifies and is code for who is human. And I think that relates to character very often as well. I think it's great to talk about when religion offers the roadmap to character that is positive, constructive, but religion in our space and time is also used locally and globally to create categories of who is human. And as we know, whether it's based on the work of Gandhi or other scholars or the studies of the rise of fascism, the first step to being able to abuse people is to dehumanize them. So I think about it in our moment right now that when we think about public policy, how has religion been used, for instance, to codify the notion that those who live without a home or are without a house are somehow less than human, or even more so that they are creating a sin, or that poverty should be criminalized, or that poverty inherently is sinful. And I think that's a language that is utilized without religion attached, but often codified by our religious traditions, beliefs, and institutions. Secondly, I think about ableism in our moment right now, in the COVID moment, and those that are given priority for sustainable life-giving systems. Who is fully human? What lives are meant to be saved? What lives are disposable? These are the real questions of our time. And lastly, I think about the notion of citizenship as a shorthand to being fully human. What happened in Atlanta in the last week brings into the forefront that those who are economically vulnerable, those who have tenuous relationship with their capacity to be integrated into society, whether or not their citizenship or their national origin, whatever challenges they face, we live in a time where citizenship, where America first, is in fact a notion that those who don't carry the right papers, don't have the correct national origin, have not been in society long enough, come and do and work in professions that are extremely make them extremely vulnerable, somehow they are also less than human. And I think part of our conversation around character is how do we mischaracterize, dehumanize, and what is the role of religion in all of those conversations? And how do we deform, as we teach, those that come to us with all of those predilections that are deeply formed over time? As we know, from the age of 0 to 5, the World Health Organization tells us we are imprinted the most in our lifetime at the very earliest stage with antisocial or pro-social behaviors and beliefs.
I feel like I could listen to these other three panelists all day. I feel bad taking up any space, but I'd rather listen to them. So I want to just briefly firstly, before addressing the issue of the content of character and how to cultivate that, on the meta level, I think that the beginning for training for clergy and for ongoing training for clergy out in the field is self-awareness. And self-awareness involves process groups to make sense of one's growing, evolving personality, growing and processing needs, the ability to express one's inner core to people who can be trusted. I'm a big proponent of therapy and the need to be a part of a healing process, a self-awareness process. And not only psychologically, but on the moral front, I think most faith traditions, one way or another, talk about that the vices we hate most in the world are the same vices we have to uproot in ourselves, and for us to see our own shadows. And so this self-awareness piece is to realize that we have our own shadows and we have to own and work to uproot those very ills in society that we're combating within ourselves. And this is about the soul holding the self rather than the self holding the soul in many ways, that we actually are aware enough that we can see ourselves, we can hold ourselves and be able to hold that and that be something malleable. Now, in terms of how do we do it once that self-awareness is there, to me, the most obvious is the modeling, making sure that the people inside these institutions represent these higher values and that they're always doing more than they're preaching. I know many great preachers who also do good things, but their actions are never running faster than the words. And the people who have influenced me mostly are people who, yes, they were good speakers, but really they were someone who they jumped when someone died, right, to go support them. They jumped when there was a need, and they really lived by humble action. To give another example, there was a rabbi who was a mentor to me who I once noticed him order almond milk instead of regular milk, and I didn't understand why, and explained to me why he was vegan, and he thought that to be a clergy person means you're compassionate to all creatures. You can't eat an animal, you can't drink milk or eat eggs when there's torture involved. And if he had just preached this to me, I would have shut down and said, whoa, don't touch my food. But I just watched him, and then I listened to him reflect on why he thought all clergy need to be vegans, if we are to be people who live with compassion. And I followed his path because of the way he expressed it. Two last points. One, to respond to something Deb said around humility, which is to say that I think that that many times we want to demonstrate it within our faith communities that we are very religious, right? We really believe. And it's almost like the more fervently and absolutely you believe, right, the more religious you are. And sometimes you really believe, right? You haven't. And I think that this is so antithetical to the epistemological, to epistemic humility. Where that of a commitment to uncertainty. And the challenge that I struggle with there is how do we live with theological uncertainty, theological skepticism, while living with a morally robust clarity? To live with moral clarity, which has a little less skepticism perhaps than our theological skepticism. And I think one of the ways we see this play out is that today in religious spaces, I have seen political disposition, political commitment outweigh character commitment. Who is a person of good character? Someone who holds political position XYZ. If you believe in the same political positions as me, you are in the good character camp. It's measured by how you vote and what positions you're willing to rally behind, rather than how you live and how you advocate for those.
Thank you all. These are such stimulating conversation. I guess I'm curious, hearing a couple of you already talk about role models and knowing that character definitions are contested in many of the places where we find ourselves, especially in the public sphere. Who are some role models or exemplars for you who've shaped your understanding and practice of character? Who are some people that we could look to or that you've looked to?
Okay, well, I'll start again. a couple of things here. One was my dad. I grew up in the Deep South, and our family had a lot of very conservative friends. And during the civil rights and the busing to school children in the 60s and maybe even early 70s, some of Dad's friends, and I think my uncle had formed a motorcade to go to the state capitol to protest busting. And I was, I don't know, young teenager. And something I just said, Dad, I don't think that's right. And instead of chastising me or anything else, he always encouraged me to think for myself and stand up for myself. And so he said, sister, that's fine. And when his friends then would argue with me or try to dismiss, you know, I said, I'm not going on that motorcade. And, you know, I think what you're doing is wrong. Dad like said, listen to her, you know? And so that was one thing. The other thing was my best friend in, probably from fifth grade up was a Jewish young girl at that time, and her family had come in from New York, and they were just represented a whole different social activism. And so I spent so much time in their home and drawing for that. And I would think the third thing was my Baptist Sunday school, because those were the days before conservatism took over so much of the Baptist convention. And we were very much taught girls can do anything. Girls can be, you know, I mean, we had ministers so much, but certainly missionaries, and that God can call you every bit as much as God can call a man. And just the teaching that, to me, that behavior is inextricably linked to Christian faith. And how we live is a direct outgrowth of what we believe. And so all of that sort of meshed together, I think, was my foundation for character.
I like to think of my mama and my daddy always. They were Mississippi sharecroppers who escaped rage, when I write about it, of Cruz's house. And they migrated north, and I grew up in Chicago, consequently. But I watched my mother and my father raise us. I'm the last of 10 children, but raise us. And I owe such a debt to them, because they were the first to demonstrate character. Your language of humility, they made humility into a verb. They lived it, and it was always there. And I was thinking about the rabbi's question about, Najiba's question about religion, and how religion can be such a destructive, binding force that disturbs anything close to God. And my parents had good religion. The old enslaved Africans sang these spirituals, is you got good religion? Is it good for anything? And my folks had good religion. And that helped me in so many ways. I'm not sure I always have good religion, but they had good religion. The other people, if anyone knows me well, you must know that I'm the editor of the Howard Thurman Papers. And Thurman met me when I was in my seminary years at Garrett Theological Seminary. And I'm forever indebted to not just his tutelage, but for the incredible wisdom that is still his to share with so many people. So Thurman, King, folks in those traditions helped shape and form me. And it wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s that I discovered these wonderful women who were part of the Negro Women's Club movement. And I must tell you, nowadays, these are the ones I go to for refuge and for understanding. It's those Negro Women Club movement folks, Ida B. Wells, Nanny Helen Barrows, Mary McLeod Bethune, Anna Julia Cooper. If you haven't met them, I strongly recommend them to you.
Beth, you want to go or would you like me to? Okay. So first, the character trait that I actually love the most and think about the most is in Hebrew is called hitlamdut, which means to learn from everything and everyone. Every moment is a learning opportunity. And so there's a phrase in our Talmudic tradition that says, who is wise? One who learns from every person. And so the mentor that doesn't diminish mentorship, but it means that every person is an opportunity to learn something about virtue from. And those who I've been most impressed with who have as my teachers are people who lived with the motto, be interested, not interesting. Rather than trying to be interesting and attract followers, they have tried to be interested in their students and those around them. It's really an ethic of alterity, really centering the other. And just to point to one person was Rabbi Cook, who was a rabbi in Jerusalem many decades ago. And there was a detractor of his who would pour garbage on his head. And one day he heard this detractor needed a special medical procedure. And he, Rabbi Cook, was the only one who had a relationship with this person, this doctor in London. And when he was approached, whether he would write the letter, he immediately said, even though this was the detractor who poured garbage on his head, he said, immediately I'll write the letter and he's gonna need money for his travels. And he raised the money for his travels. And I think that I was so moved by him as someone who I watched and read so closely because of how we treat our opponents, our detractors, those who are on the opposite end of us with full dignity. It's easy to treat well people in our own camp, people who are like us ideologically or in other ways. But to truly see, going back to what Najiba was saying earlier around dehumanization, to truly value all people for their dignity. It reminds me of what Ruth Bader Ginsburg also said, would often quote from her mother-in-law, that it's helpful to be a little deaf sometimes. And in this context, what she meant was to not listen to every critique we receive, right? To not be so centered that we only serve those who love us, really, but we're really centered on others, decentering ourselves. And so I'm constantly going back and forth to find mentors, people who live by the highest virtues I want to be like, and trying to find value and virtue in everyone encountered.
So for me, again, because of what has happened in Atlanta in the last couple of days, I think Asian American women and immigrant women are heavy on my mind. And unfortunately, because of the way and the history and the portrayal of Asian American women, whether it was through immigration policies that actually forbade Asian or Chinese women from migrating to the United States or other forms of media portrayals that show Asian American women, actually both South Asian, Southeast Asian, and East Asian as docile, as objects of sexual fantasy, as exoticized, as bodies meant for colonization or bodies meant to be violated. I think about that a lot this week, and I think about all the women that I know, including my mother, including myself, I wasn't born in the United States, that work against either the exotification of bodies, the sexualization of bodies, or the invisibilization of bodies, of our bodies in so many spaces. In my work, I talk about being an embodied interruption, that before I even say something, I'm interrupting spaces with or without saying anything because of what I carry. What I find powerful about women in our community, in the South Asian community, we affectionately call them aunties. In every Asian community, there are such strong role models of aunties. It doesn't have to be just your mother. You don't have to have had children, but this capacity for women who often remain nameless, uncelebrated, in their societies that come through a process of migration, which is not easy. And thinking about the thousands of women that came through, whether it's Angel Island on the West Coast, the history of Asian migration, or the Sikh farmers that came into the Pacific Northwest and were told when they were coming, when communities were migrating, that there's a tide of turbans, and we're talking about 100 years ago, anti-Asian violence is not a new thing. I just think about these women who came with very little, who came with so much, you know, so much bravery, but are often not recognized. Mm-hmm. So that intersection of race, class, gender, ethnicity, and national origin, to me, that represents a tenacity of character to be able to also raise the next generation. So I think about my mother raising 6 kids, giving up her profession as a professor in Kashmir to be able to come to the United States and raise 6 children, really without much support, because you leave your family support as an immigrant. And I'll end with, in the past 4 years, the women that have most inspired me are women who have crossed the southern border and have been separated from their children, and some whom I've been with in accompaniment to courts that have lost their children because their children were taken away from them permanently, being on the phone with them as they are trying to reach their children who are across the country. So those immigrant women for me have always been an example, especially that those that don't have the access and privilege that I've had to education and other facilities, they continue to survive and flourish and bring an incredible amount of wisdom in that process. And I hope that we as religious, or if we consider ourselves leaders, understand what wisdom and resilience comes with surviving such odds.
Yeah, thank you. That I love that phrase, the tenacity of character. And the examples that you're providing are such powerful ones. So thank you. I wonder if, as we think about this notion of tenacity of character, religious leaders face a lot of obstacles when they're trying to lead with integrity, and a lot of challenges even to the values that they hold or the perspectives that they have about moral character or about decisions that are made. So how do we think about, I mean, what are some of the biggest obstacles you think religious leaders face when they're trying to lead with integrity? And how do we help them to develop that kind of tenacity that's required for them to hold on to what they believe and yet be in conversations that can change other people's attitudes and beliefs?
I think, to use the words of Ella Baker, that strong people don't need strong leaders. We live in a time, we've come out of a period of time that has celebrated the notion of charisma, even if it's a charisma that's caustic, if it's a charisma that is difficult to explain or understand. Historically, religious leaders have risen in their ranks, not just by piety, but their ability to sometimes manipulate, their ability to play the political game of religion. And let's be very frank about that. That religious institutions, as beautiful and as much as they bring to the table, and this is across all traditions, there is no one tradition or group that has a monopoly on this, that capacity for charisma, and this also exists with professors, it exists with any profession where you become an instructor or you carry some modality of authority over others. And it's in many ways, it's a two-edged sword. You rise as you become more charismatic. And one of my mentors, Sarah Smith Orr, talks about the difference between transformational leadership and transactional leadership. And she has 4 eyes to leadership development. And one of them focuses on the idea that once, for instance, you are surrounded only by people who agree with you, that you are in the most toxic state of leadership. So I think we have to be very careful that it's humility, but it's also self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And it's also this capacity to understand that the very gifts we bring to the table are also the very things that will feed us into narcissism in a way that doesn't just serve the self, but then creates a insatiable appetite for accumulating power. And that kind of perspective, ultimately, I would argue, destroys the self, but is rewarded by institutions, by media, by many other aspects. And this is really the fundamental story of of all of the great prophets of every religious tradition, that in the beginning of most missions, it was standing with those. And I would add to that, whether it's Jesus, who in the Muslim tradition is Prophet Isa, whether it's Buddha or Prophet Muhammad in the Muslim tradition, it wasn't just giving lip service to standing with those at the margin. It was elevating. And I think of it often with the example of Jesus with standing with lepers. It meant to be an embodied, engaged form of solidarity. So that you are in that moment, whether it was during the United States AIDS crisis, whether it's dealing with the reality of COVID in this moment, are we physically in that space where people who are being pushed aside to the margin, are we following the example of those prophets to say, this is not only, there is a saying of Prophet Muhammad says that there is no veil between the prayer of the oppressed and God. And in my work, I don't think of that as that I am meant to have pity or even charity for those who are dealing with oppression, but that is actually the most holy and sacred place to be, because those are the people closest to God. And if they pray against me, they have instant access to God. So it's probably a self-protection for whatever one believes about what comes after this life. But I wanted to point that out, that it's an embodied solidarity. And I think about nuns that were ministering physically to those that were dealing with the HIV crisis in the United States. That is an incredibly sacred act. And I've really been thinking about that moment that we live in now, and what does it mean to be embodied in our solidarity, to stand physically close and with those that are at the border, that are seeking asylum. What does that mean to be with people? Does it mean just to talk about an issue, say it from the pulpit? What does it mean in our moment to show that kind of embodied solidarity, that embodied connection, and that elevation that happens when souls collect and unite with the reality that, as the Muslim tradition and scripture says, God gives dignity. Dignity is not rendered by humans to others. Every human soul is imbued with dignity. And so what does that mean to co-create spaces that are dignified and dignifying for each other?
Might I follow up with Saeed? I did get that correct, didn't I? I'm so convinced that one of the greatest challenge, if not the greatest challenge, that leaders and I would say human beings face is the need for recognition. And in my ethical leadership model, and with integrity, but its correlate in public space has to do with recognition. People will bend themselves out of sort to be seen and heard. To be cared for is what they're really asking for. You see, especially on quote unquote charismatic leaders or the great men of leadership, is this need to be seen, to be heard, and not just simply seen and heard, but to be seen and heard powerful and good. And so part of this struggle for me when I teach ethical leadership is always bring students back to the need for integrity, not simply as being honest or truth telling, which is important, but for a sense of wholeness. And all religious traditions have a sense of this, whether it's written in our doctrines of salvation or whatever. It's about how do I find this self, and which I mentioned earlier, what is my name? The young man for Professor Wall, what is my name? Who am I? Then I might not be at the mercy of the look of the other. Remember, Sartre said, hell is other people, because we beg we wrest away from them their look, their gaze. And once a leader, I think, has a good sense of integrity and who has begun to understand that self-recognition, self-awareness is the place where they begin, then they are in a position to act and speak courageously for justice and to live compassionately. But integrity becomes the foundational pillar for me, for folks who would do the work that you're speaking to, of crossing boundaries, identifying with the poorest of the poor, with the lepers and those who have been constructed as lepers in our various societies.
I'm happy to go next. On this question of obstacles for religious leaders to live with and lead with integrity, I'll say something slightly critical towards religious leaders and then one thing more charitably. Slightly more critical is that I have toyed with the idea as to whether we should have what should be done to maintain a license, to keep one's ordination requirements. How do we build accountability from our denominations, ethical accountability towards the people in the field? Other professions have to take ongoing class credits, to maintain their license. And here, I'm not talking of filling people in the field with just knowledge, but rather towards this area of character development, how people can lose themselves in this field. They can really lose themselves and get carried away in many ways. And there needs to be accountability from those denominations that one operates from. So that's the thing that's slightly more critical, slightly more charitably. My colleagues, I have found over and over, live with a lot of career instability for various reasons. And because of that career instability, they operate from a place of fear. And because they operate from fear, they spend most of their time with the most powerful rather than the most vulnerable to maintain their career. Who are the wealthy people who are going to keep the budget going for my church or synagogue or wherever? And who are the influencers here who are going to help me to maintain my career, keep my job? And I believe our work should be most aligned with the most vulnerable, not the most powerful. When we lead from a place of fear, that can block out the potential for integrity to prioritize, to make moral priorities and operate from that place.
Yes, I could not agree more with you. And I want to jump off from that because I think the obstacles that I personally dealt with were attendance, because none of us want to, after we've built something up, the temptation is, okay, now I'm not going to say anything to offend people. So we were in the odd position, Triune, of we had built it up as a ministry to the homeless, and people literally came there to worship with us, rich, poor, professors, students, business people, doctors, lawyers, because they knew they were going to be sitting with homeless people. And so that was, they had chosen to do that. So we already had a big step up on a lot of congregations I could talk about race, I could talk about socioeconomic inequality, no problem. However, the issues that I knew I needed to talk about and was afraid to from time to time, LGBTQ, and the actions of our political administration, because I knew I had both sides in the congregation. Well, the question I tried to ask myself was, when I'm 80 years old and I look back, am I going to be proud of what I said? Or am I going to say, ooh, I missed a chance to speak out? And so I told my board as soon as marriage was legalized, same-sex marriage was legalized, I went to them and I was absolutely trembling because I loved my job at that point and that would have been a bad time to lose it. But I said, I'm going to do a same-sex marriage and I hope you don't fire me, but I understand if you do. And most of them said, we wouldn't expect anything else of you. But one man, it made an argument that I have to admit, I didn't go along with it, but he said, Deb, I'm just afraid you're going to destroy everything you've built here, you know, with the homeless by jumping over into this LGBTQ arena. And I said, I understand what you're saying, but I've got to do it. So I think we make those judgments all the time. But you do get, you know, you can get that pushback of, am I going to harm the true good I've already done? And you know, and I think, I guess that's where character comes in. You've just got to decide. I felt like what we were saying was, we are going to stand for justice for everybody.
Thank you all so much for these wonderful responses. This has been such a substantive conversation. I think as we come up on about 11:15, we have about 15 or maybe 18 minutes left. And I'd like to just ask one last question. And I think you've already been answering this in terms of providing a kind of your wisdom for people who are religious leaders. But I guess the last question I would ask is, what advice would you give or what guidance would you give to people that you meet who are trying to discern whether religion and religious leadership is the profession that they think God is calling them to? Character is a part of all the professions. That's at the center of the conference that we're enjoying these 2 days. But I wonder, what advice would we give to students or to people who are discerning whether religious leadership is a career that they should pursue? Perhaps another part of that question is, you know, if you're a religious leader, how do you contribute to the moral formation of our society or to the values that we're trying to cultivate in our societies?
So I always tell people that religion is always on the table. Religion is everywhere. You just have to see it. And one thing that I would really encourage all of us is to think about our definition of religion, not just religious leaders. I'm often told by people that, for instance, folks don't see religious diversity. When I work with my graduate students, one of their first projects in the interreligious dialogue and leadership course is, before they would come to campus, was to map in their community other religious groups. And they would say, well, you know, I don't see anyone. And what I would say is, you're not seeing religion. For instance, there's research on South Asian women and other communities where beauty shops are spaces of religious and spiritual gathering and formation. Where in some communities, the coffee shop, I'm thinking about, for instance, Ethiopian communities, where gathering and getting coffee together is an act of connection and contribution. So we have spiritual and religious spaces that exist in American religions, love and the love to look at bricks and mortar, pews. If you look at the history of religions that migrate to the US, over time, even architecturally, they begin to take on some of the practices and the nuances and the capacity to see religion as one framing of bricks and mortar, pews, stage, podium, all of these things began to happen to American religions across the board, because for some reason, our framing of religion can transform. I also think it's very important to think about indigenous traditions. We haven't, for instance, when I was teaching here on the West Coast in graduate theological education, my students from Pacific Islander background, Hawaiian, also Tongan and Samoan, would come, and when they would dress to preach, the skirt around it would have the fronds from the trees on the island. And I would ask, is that a spiritual practice? And helping them elevate the definition of culture and belief to that of a spiritual and religious identity, that in many ways, we are embodied in a hybridity of culture and religion. for me, I come from 30 something plus generations of spiritual leaders in my community. So I remember getting in trouble. I gave a talk and I was talking about agency and that I don't have the agency to choose religion in the same way others do, because if I were to leave my religious tradition, it would mean leaving family. It would mean leaving a lineage. It would mean leaving a culture. It would mean leaving a language. It would mean leaving an identity that's been carried in my family for over 1,000 years. So I point that out because I think so many people want to have this conversation. And I think, as we heard in the keynote, that I think we live in a time where, because the construction of religion is so narrow sometimes, or what is seen as religion is so narrow, we don't understand how people come with either a capacity for a religious imagination, but they may not be using the language that's familiar. An academic or ecclesial language may be lagging behind where people are in their actual formation. So I would just encourage us, as we think about religion, to understand that it functions in so many different ways and in so many different places. And that in this moment, what is important for me as I think about forming spiritual and religious leaders is to articulate our capacity to have religion constructively engage and problem solve the major issues of our time. While I talked about how religion was deeply often complicit, all religions, not just one, in some oppressive systems, I was fascinated in working with the Carter Center on the Syria conflict, in talking about religion and conflict, that people who, because of their religious tradition, had been deeply, had experienced violence, as they were coming out of it, they still wanted and yearned for spiritual language. And it's very confusing to mediators who do international work that see religion often as the problem. And they ask me, what is this? We don't understand, Najeeb, but why are people still yearning for that spiritual language, for that spiritual connection? And I think what we can think through is, what and how do we work as healers of gaps, not just between people, but of a magnification of the capacity relationally to address the problems of our time? And that, to me, is the most exciting thing. And what that means is training religious leaders, not just to work as I do in my own capacity, and just finished editing a book this year across religious traditions. We need to be able to be ambassadors for the other in our own religious traditions. And I often tell people, it's not what you say about me when you're with me. It's what you say from your pulpit and in your Sunday school about other religious traditions that is, in fact, the most constructive or dangerous knowledge. Mm. And so I think what we say about others, whether it's religious communities or others, I think for me, religious education is a space where we have to begin to challenge age-old ideas that we have, frankly, very often been formed on. We have to move to what Patinsky talks about as allophilia, which is not the group dynamic from previous centuries where commonality was based on common enemy and common hate. Mm-hmm. What if we move to a space where identity is based on common good, but not a good, as he says in his work, that pushes a horizontal identity, but recognizes subgroups and understands that justice for all is what binds us together.
I'm so aware of time. I'll simply say amen to everything. Amen. And also, I think that for those who are seeking a life of religious devotion, however defined religious, one has to ask, what is calling you? Perhaps who is calling you? And what are they asking you to do? So if I'm being asked to expand my brand, I might want to interrogate that voice. And if it is the larger conversation that's going on right now in our political divides in this nation, I need to ask which side of that divide is calling me, and how do I interrogate both? Because I think ultimately we are involved in religious meaning making, and that there might very well be a new religious narrative in the making that is frightening to many who are holding on to dead things. But I think for a new generation of seekers, it will be looking forward to these new futures which have already come to us.
Well, I would just say, I guess I don't think that religious leadership, character, and character can be divorced from our speech and our behavior. When I do weddings, I quote Jesus's statement about, in this way you will know they are my disciples, by their love for one another, that we cannot see inside people. All we know about love is how we see them speaking and behaving. And of course, I use that between the bride and groom, that I hope you will always speak and behave in ways that illustrate love. And just sort of that, I think that's the imperative. If you are, if one wants to go into leadership, you know, do you feel that way about your actions? Are you, you know, are you ready, willing, interested in living out that love every minute of your life?
There are just three quick things here. Firstly, I do think that that people should go in with their eyes open on how demanding and 24/7 this can be to live by a higher standard, where one is asked to soar above the petty and not be pulled down by the petty, and to always kind of have to take that higher road, and to understand what would be involved in a lifestyle like that for themselves, for their spouse, for their partner, for their children. And so there are some hard questions to ask. The second is to live with a balance of hope and have the finger on the pulse of the current reality. I know people who want to be in one or the other, but I think that people do need religious leaders to help cultivate resilience by helping to cultivate hope in a community for what a future can look like, that which is not detached from the current reality, that lives with an empathy of current suffering. And the last thing I would say is, you know, the rabbi who leads the rabbinical school where I went, his question to everyone was, do you love people? Do you really love people? Because you can't come here if you just love God, or you just love text study, or you love ideas, or if you love to hear yourself speak, you need to love to hear other people speak, right? And do you, and love them enough to challenge them, you know, and that when you listen, you're not listening to as an organizer, to organize them, to build power, to build your membership. You're listening to them in a Martin Buber kind of fashion, an I-Thou fashion, because they are the ends in themselves. And not everyone wants to do that. That's really hard to be in that kind of space of vulnerability. And so those are three of the questions I would ask.
Thank you so much. And let me just say, as we come to the end of this time, I'm very grateful to each of you and for the opportunity to be able to listen into your conversation. I feel as though these moments have changed my perspective, and I am continuing my journey of becoming due to your presence here on this day. So thank you so much. I believe that Michael Lamb is going to rejoin us now and give us a few final words.
Great. Well, thank you so much. That was a wonderful conversation about character and religious leadership. I heard not only profound insights, but also powerful questions. You know, who are our role models? Which character should we pursue? What is our name? Who is human? How can we be humble and create space for those who might be most vulnerable? So I really want to appreciate you for these questions, which I'll be dwelling with and living with, hopefully, in the days to come. So thank you all for your profound wisdom.